Pastor said, I'm here from Rogersville, Tennessee, and there is a funny story behind this invitation. I did share it with the Sunday school class this morning. Your pastor, several months back in the previous year, had started to talk with ambassador speakers about the possibility of my coming up here, and I knew that that meant getting on an airplane. And the only other person, as he said, that I have ever flown for would be James Dobson. And I just hated it. It just terrified me to my very core. And I decided then and there, never ever again, when those wheels touched down, I am not getting on another airplane. And I meant it. Until this person, Kevin Binkley, came into my life and changed all that. Your pastor is very charismatic. When I first heard... Well, I don't know about charismatic, but he's really good at begging. When he does his yearly sermon on tithing, as I know all good Baptist ministers do, you all probably just leave your money at the altar and go on home. I couldn't believe that he actually talked me into this. Anyway, when I first heard he was interested, I said, well, let me check my schedule, knowing good and well that I didn't really have anything this weekend scheduled. So what I did was I called a friendly pastor that I knew from my hometown in Maryland and said, you know, you've been wanting me to come out there. How about Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, which I could drive to, you see, and in my nice low-to-the-ground SUV. And he said, well, sure, let's schedule you for that day. And so I said, yes, I got out of it. So I called and said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to decline that invitation. And I was really happy for months, you know, knowing that I would not have to fly. And I was so comfortable and enjoyed my Christmas holiday in Florida with Mother and came back to the worst message that could possibly have been on my answering machine. The pastor had some internal issues that he had to deal with at the church and couldn't have a speaker this weekend. So I had to, you know, fess up and tell the agency that my schedule had an opening, you know, just hoping that it would go by peacefully and I wouldn't hear from anything. And all of a sudden, this Kevin Binkley person pops up again and starts begging, practically salivating at the mouth, trying to get me to come out here. And so I did everything but send somebody up here to nail the door shut. But eventually I relented, and I got on those planes yesterday, sitting there absolutely braced for the explosion that I knew was coming, you know, as if I was going to my execution. But fortunately, I got here in one piece, and I'm just tickled to death. Anyway, back in 1991, the story goes like this. I was pregnant with my third daughter. I had a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old at home. The house was pretty crazy, as you mothers can probably imagine. And we did a routine ultrasound. And the ultrasound unfortunately showed that the baby that I was already in love with, already connected to, I was told she was not going to live. That she probably would not survive the rest of the pregnancy, but surely as soon as the cord was cut, she would die within moments. Reason being that most of my daughter's brain was indeed missing. There was very little there. She had the worst case of hydrocephalus that they had ever seen. Hydrocephalus meaning water on the brain, to those of you who may not know. When further ultrasounds were done, they noted a badly deformed brain stem, which controls breathing, heartbeat, other things like that. They said that it was deformed beyond its ability to function on its own once the baby would be born. And unfortunately, part of her brain that did develop was on the outside of her skull. The doctors measure whether or not a child's prognosis is life or death by how much measurement on a ruler, when they put it up to the screen, how much brain tissue is showing between the skull and the edge. And death is imminent between below like 2 or 3 centimeters. That measurement means death is imminent. Donna's measurement was 2 millimeters. Of brain. That's all there was. Multiple centers were missing. The rest of it was badly damaged. So they said that she was, and I quote, completely incompatible with life. And my first instinct was, okay, what do we do to fix this? And they said, nothing. We will schedule you for termination with a late-term abortion immediately. And I told them, no, I wasn't going to do that for several reasons. One, I loved her, and it didn't matter to me if she was going to live for 5 minutes or 5 days or 5 months. She was not going to die at the hands of an abortionist. Number two, her life didn't belong to me. I may have been present when she was created, but I did not create her with my two hands. I knew that her life belonged to God, and it was not mine for the taking. And I wanted to at least hold her. You know, number three, I wanted to at least hold her while she died. If I did have to let go of her, you know, I didn't want her to die, you know, in the horrible way that these babies' lives are taken. So I refused. And then I went to another doctor to try and get prenatal care, a high-risk obstetrician at Johns Hopkins, and they wouldn't even make me an appointment based on her diagnosis. And I kept going like a vagabond from hospital to hospital begging for prenatal care, and they all turned me away. They said the only thing we'll do is an abortion. So I just said, okay, well, I guess I'll just move into the motel down the street, and when I go into labor, you'll have to deliver whether you want to or not. So, you know, let's just at least do it safely. And when they knew that I was not going to give in to their pressure, I guess you mothers can relate to what it would be like to have your prenatal care taken from you at 7 months into your pregnancy and being told that they're not going to care for you or your baby anymore unless you agree to abort. So they finally relented and did the cesarean section, and I just love God's timing. She was born 2 days before Thanksgiving in 1991. And the arrangements before the cesarean section were supposed to be that she would be operated on for the fluid on the brain, put in a tube called a shunt right after she was born, and she'd be given all this supportive care. That's what the plan was supposed to be. But as I lay in my hospital bed after the surgery, that plan was not put into practice. The medical community at that particular hospital began actively trying to hasten my child's death. The tube that was going in her arm for IV was supposed to be nutrition. It was nothing but water. She laid there starving for 3 days. She laid there suffering in unimaginable agony with 2.5 pounds of fluid crushing what was left of her brain from the inside out. And laying there crying out in all that pain, it was tough to see. So finally I arrived in the NICU at 3 days old, and I told the doctors there, you're going to have to operate and you're going to do it today. And they said, and I quote, while she laid there crying with a diaper on, this fetus has no chance. She has no brain and is not worth our time. Finally, after several hours of debate, I did get them to relent and take her to the OR. But at 10 days old, after the surgery was completed, they sent her home with me with no ability to suck or swallow or take in nutrition and no feeding tube. They refused her a feeding tube based on her diagnosis, the fact that she was going to die. They made some comments about natural selection and all of that. So they sent her home, and 3 days later, I took her back to the hospital after she lost consciousness from starving. And it took me 18 hours to convince them to readmit her. They tried to turn me away and make me go home. While in the hospital, they discovered that she had a shunt infection. They refused her antibiotics. They told me they were just going to let nature take its course. I had to fight for that. She began having 15 seizures a day. I had to fight for medication for that. Every therapy, every surgery, every drop of food I had to fight for this baby. As a matter of fact, when I began feeding her in the hospital after the surgeons wrote for her to be NPO, in other words, don't feed her anything, no more hydration, no nothing, unless she can take it in by herself, no more supportive care through IVs or anything. I began having to sneak food to my own child under my coat in the middle of the night and try to feed her with syringes. But the only problem with that was, because of the brain damage, everything that I tried to feed her just came back up through her mouth and nose. So after unsuccessfully trying to get a feeding tube from every surgeon in the hospital, I just cried out to God. And this is where, this was the first step on a long journey to coming as close to God as I think I ever have in my entire life. I just got down on my knees and laid my hands on my daughter's belly and prayed and cried out to God, please help me, do something, help me know what to do. I was 26 years old, a high school graduate, the child of a steel worker. I'd never been exposed to this kind of stuff. I didn't know what to do. And moments after I cried out to God, in walks this young girl from the dietary department with a tray of food that was obviously for an older infant. It was certainly a mistake. And on the tray was a box of baby rice cereal, a jar of baby bananas, and some formula. And I thought to myself, you know, if I could get something that was heavy enough to stay in the bottom of her stomach so that it didn't flow back up so easily, maybe she'll get some nutrition and stay alive. So I just mixed some of those ingredients together and took a nearby syringe that had been left in the room and drew it up. And I fed her one drop of it, and it stayed down. And until she learned to suck a bottle on her own at 7 months of age, that's how I had to feed her to keep her alive. One drop at a time. It took 90 minutes to get 2 ounces of paste in her, which is how much she needed to stay alive. So I had to feed her for 90 minutes, let her rest for 90 minutes, and then feed her again around the clock for 7 months. It was really hard, but as a mother, what do? Do you let your baby starve to death? Or do you, you know, you got to do what you have to do. And I was so grateful to God that he gave me that knowledge of what to do for her, because I had no idea what to do. As time went on, she began to progress and do very well. We got her into physical therapy, and at a year and a half, she was using sign language and she was walking. She was doing very well, and she got struck again with another shunt infection. This time, within hours of the fever starting, she was in a coma with a temperature of 106, with encephalitis and meningitis, either of which can kill you by themselves. And we were told that she wouldn't live through the night. We were told to come to the hospital as quickly as we could because she wasn't going to make it much longer. When I got there, she was already mottled, blue and gray, and she was barely able to breathe, and she had tubes coming out of everywhere. Her heart had stopped twice, and they told me to go to the bedside and say goodbye to her. And I took her little hand, and I stroked it, and I told her how much I loved her, and that if it was really hurting so badly that she couldn't stand it, that she could go. But there were so many things that I wanted to do with her. And I said, if you'll stay, I promise you I'll make your life as wonderful as I can. And before I knew it, in a few days' time, she was beginning to open her eyes. And I stayed by her bed, and I prayed over her. And when she finally came to several days later, I was so excited. But that excitement was short-lived because we realized that the fever and everything that she had been through had completely wiped out her memory. She didn't even know me. She thought I was a stranger. She didn't know her own name, and she had regressed back to a four-month-old level. So I thought, well, this just means I have to start over again. And we did, and eventually she came home, and she began to get stronger, and she entered preschool at the age of 3 1/2. And at the end of that school year, I was called into the administrator's office for a meeting, and she said, we have to tell you something. Donna Joy cannot come back to preschool next year. It was a special ed preschool. And I said, why? And I started to cry, and they said, because she's way too advanced for the special ed environment. She needs to go to a regular kindergarten. And I was just blown away by that because of everything we had been through. By the time she reached the age of 5, I was sitting in the house with her one day, and she was playing with her blocks on the floor, and I was watching C-SPAN, and they were discussing partial birth abortions, which is the procedure that they tried so hard to get me to use to take her life with. And I heard them say that children with hydrocephalus and holoprosencephaly, which is what Donna has, brain outside the head and all these other things, how they can't possibly survive, and we shouldn't force women to have these children at a risk to their own lives. And I said, well, you know, this is all lies. I can't put up with this. So I thought to myself, I've got to say something to these people. And then I sat back down on my couch and I said, you're the kid of a steelworker. You've got no college education. Nobody's going to care what you think. And then I heard God say in that still small voice in my spirit, you know what? I have given you a tremendous gift, many gifts, over and over and over. I've been there for you. And I've got more for you to do than just sitting around in your living room looking darling. So I dressed her up and I took her down to my congressman's office with all of her medical files in hand. And he was just flabbergasted. He said, this is exactly what we've been looking for. And I think I knew then why God had given me this child. It wasn't just for my own joy, which there's been plenty of, but this child was going to have an impact on this nation, though I didn't know it when she was born. And from then on, we were thrust into the national spotlight when Senator Santorum, who was spearheading the issue for the Senate, was able to use her as the crux of his argument as to why this procedure is not medically necessary, like the other side was saying that it was. And he had a face that he could put on the issue. And I'm going to show that to you. That's her when she was born. You can see how swollen her head was. That's her there before her first operation. She was pretty sick. That's where you can see that's the only picture we have of the brain protruding through the back of her head. That was right before that surgery was done at 2 months of age. That's her learning to walk when she was, this was after the coma. She was learning to walk again. She was about 2 there. That's her in special ed preschool, right before she got kicked out for being too smart. That's all 4 of the girls. That's her in the ponytails holding her new baby sister. Incidentally, they told me that I was risking my fertility and the ability to have future children, and that didn't seem to be a problem for me. So that blew that argument out of the water, too. And I'll never forget that I told Rick in private, you know, that we had gotten pregnant with Shayla on the first try. And, of course, he felt compelled to tell that story to the whole country. And I'm sitting there between 2 NBC producers going, oh, my gosh. Now the whole country is picturing me getting pregnant with this baby. I don't need that. You can't tell Rick anything. That's her talking about her from the Senate floor. I guess it was pretty hard for people to look into those big blue eyes and say that she shouldn't have lived. My clicker's not working. There we go. That's Tony Snow, the former White House press secretary. He's a good buddy of Donna's. He's got her pretty spoiled. There's us right after the Focus on the Family program. I'm still in one piece after the plane ride there. Quite amazing. A lot of turbulence over the Rocky Mountains. I wasn't happy at all. That's her when she was about 6, 7, 8 years old, a town we used to live in, Greencastle, Pennsylvania. She loves to pose. Yeah, she took karate lessons for a while. She got karate lessons for her 6th birthday as a gift. You should know probably at this point that Donna's brain multiple centers are missing, and centers that are responsible for different things. She has no fine motor center. She has no gross motor. She has no speech. She has no memory center. She has no independent thought center, and her visual center is extremely damaged, and it's just barely there. Yet, you know, she took karate lessons, and this past year she took 2 medals on the Special Olympics track team, so much for that. I guess God does what he wants to do, whether or not we have the brain available to us or not. As you can see, she's quite beautiful. And as far as being born without a face, you can see obviously God gave her with both hands. She's absolutely a beautiful girl. All my kids are pretty. I really don't know how that happened, but she looks like her daddy. You know, that's how that happened. She is just such a beautiful, beautiful child. This is one of my favorite pictures. She loves to ride horses. You know, so much for not being able to get off a respirator. She never even went on one. She loves to climb trees. That's her and her daddy. As you can see, she looks just like him. That's her favorite school teacher. She's in 8th grade at Rogersville Middle School. She is in special ed, but she is the... she has the highest grades in the class. Her last few spelling tests were all perfect scores, and her best subject is math. That's our church back home, our pastor. That's her all dressed up. She was in a beauty pageant, and she did win a crown. She loves to swim. She has friends, as you can see. She's very active. That's for the Home Life article that was just referenced up there. She models, she's on the drama team at church, she's in the church choir. That's her dressed up as Snow White. She loves Disney princess stuff. She has a princess complex, actually. She wants to grow up to be one, but since, you know, Prince William's so busy, I don't know how that's going to happen. And since I'm too chicken to fly to London anyway, you know, it's just not going to happen at all, poor kid. That's her at the beauty pageant after she'd won her crown. And she loves to put it on when company comes that hasn't seen her in it. She'll go right into her room, put a little crown on, and come out in it. She's a little bit of a ham, not sure where she got that. Everybody notices those big blue eyes right off. And, you know, during our time in the Senate, she did win over a lot of hearts that were on the other side of this issue. And it's easy to see how that was done. In 2003, we were invited by President Bush to go to the White House and watch him sign that. That was a real thrill. Since she's not here, I can talk about it. Just don't anybody tell her I said so. President Bush waved at her, and she wet her pants. Poor kid. She was so impressed. She loves to swim in the ocean. This was just taken in Florida a month ago. She, just like any other teenager, you know, she's got her friends, and she's got this little boy at church that's really interested in her. We're watching that real carefully. That's her picture there with Senator Santorum in front of the Capitol building, holding her little bear. Oh, I like that picture. You know, I think there's one thing that I want you to take away from this, and that's Our value. I want everybody to remember that it's great that Donna can do all the things that she does, but that's not what makes her valuable. She's intrinsically valuable because she was conceived into the human family 17 years ago. That's why she's valuable, because she was created by our Lord. And, you know, I've really enjoyed sharing with you guys today. Our ministry is to, you know, go around and share with as many people as possible, as long as I don't have to fly. I'm really getting back at him today, because not only was I mad that he made me use a plane, but he took food off my plate last night at dinner. You really need to have him over to eat, because he acts like he doesn't get enough. If he's got to take something from the speaker he hired, you know, obviously he's hungry. I'm sorry, but he's just a mess. It didn't take me long to realize that. anybody who can talk me into taking an airplane, you know, it's not so shabby. We look after women all over the country by phone and by computer, who have special needs children like Donna Joy. We're able to do this full time. It's amazing because what we run our family and our ministry on is in 1 month is what most people make in a week. But God has been gracious in how He's provided us ways to do what we do. And I've not told our church family this. In fact, I've only discussed it with my husband and my best friend. I'd like you all to pray because upon returning, this is why I have to take the plane back, whether I want to or not, because immediately upon returning, my husband and I are applying for a full-time pro-life missions assignment in Florida, something that we would really like to do, being house parents at a maternity home for unwed girls. That is about as pro-life a commitment as you can make, and to run the adjacent pregnancy center. So we're really excited about this interview. If you all could not only pray that the plane doesn't blow up on the way back, pray that, you know, God's will be done in that situation, in that interview. Right now I'm going to turn it back over to Pastor Kevin, and I know he's going to want to hurry up because he's got some people to steal from at lunch today, so. Look, nobody, as you can see, I'm not going to fib to you. Nobody gets between me and my hot buttered rolls, okay? And lives to tell about it.